faces dark and young and solemn. They'd ask his advice on matters of fortune. They'd tell each other stories about his incredible good luck, how he never got a scratch, not once. Not even that time back in January when the mortar round dropped right next to his foxhole. Amazing, they'd say. Man's plugged into the spirit world. John Wade encouraged the mystique. It was useful, he discovered, to cultivate a reserved demeanor, to stay silent for long stretches of time. When pressed, he'd put on a quick display of his powers, doing a trick or two, using the everyday objects all around him. Much could be done, for example, with his jackknife and a corpse. Other times he'd do some fortune-telling, offering prophecies of things to come. "Wicked vibes," he'd say. "Wicked day ahead." And then he'd gaze out across the paddies. He couldn't go wrong. Wickedness was everywhere. "I'm the company witch doctor," he wrote Kathy. "These guys listen to me. They actually believe in this crap." Kathy did not write back for several weeks, and then she sent only a postcard. "A piece of advice. Be careful with the tricks. One of these days you'll make me disappear." It was signed Kath. There were no endearments, no funny stories. Instantly, John felt the old terrors rise up again, all the ugly possibilities. He couldn't shut them off. Even in bright daylight, the pictures kept blowing through his head. Dark bedrooms, for instance. Kathy's diaphragm. What he wanted was to spy on her again. It was like a craving. But all he could do was wait. At night, his blood bubbled. He couldn't stop wondering. In the third week of February, when a letter finally arrived, he detected a new coolness in her tone, a new distance and formality. She talked about a movie she'd seen, an art gallery she'd visited, a terrific Spanish beer she'd discovered. His imagination filled in the details. February was a wretched month. Kathy was one problem, the war another. Two men were lost to landmines. A third was shot through the neck. Weber died of an exploding kidney. Morale was low. As they plodded from ville to ville, the men talked in quiet voices about how the magic had worn off, how Sorcerer had lost contact with the spirit world. They seemed to blame him. Nothing direct, just a general standoffishness. There were no more requests for tricks. No banter, no jokes. As the days piled up, John Wade felt increasingly cut off from the men, cut off from Kathy and his own future. A stranded sensation, totally lost. At times he wondered about his mental health. The internal terrain had gone blurry. He couldn't get his bearings. "Something's wrong," he wrote Kathy. "Don't do this to me. I'm not blind. Sorcerer can see." She wrote back fast. "You scare me." And then for many days he received no letters at all, not even a postcard, and the war kept squeezing in on him. The notion of the finite took hold and would not let go. In the second week of February, a sergeant named Reinhardt was shot dead by sniper fire. He was eating a Mars bar. He took a bite and laughed and started to say something, and then dropped in the grass under a straggly old palm tree, his lips dark with chocolate, his brains smooth and liquid. It was a fine tropical afternoon, bright and balmy, very warm, but John Wade found himself shivering. The cold came from inside him, a deep freeze, he thought. And then he felt something he'd never felt before, a force so violent it seemed to pick him up by the shoulders. It was rage, in part, but it was also illness and sorrow and evil. All kinds of things. For a few seconds he hugged himself, feeling the cold, and then he was moving. There was no real decision. He'd lost touch with his own volition, his own arms and legs, and in the hours afterward he would remember how he seemed to glide toward the enemy position, not running. Just a fast, winging, disconnected glide, circling in from behind, not thinking at all, slipping through a tangle of deep brush, and keeping low and letting the glide take him up to a little man in black trousers and a black shirt. He would remember the man turning. He would remember their eyes colliding. Other things he would remember only dimly, how he was carried forward by the glide, how his lungs seemed full of ashes, and how at one point his rifle muzzle came up against the little man's cheekbone. He would remember an immense pressure in his stomach. He would remember Kathy's flat eyes reproaching him for the many things he had done and not done. There was no sound at all, none that Sorcerer would remember. The little man's cheekbone was gone. Later, the men in Charlie Company couldn't stop talking about Sorcerer's new trick. They went on and on. "Poof," somebody said. "No lie, just like that. Poof." At dusk, they dragged the sniper's body into a nearby hamlet. An audience of villagers was summoned at gunpoint. A rope was then secured to the dead man's feet, another to his wrists, and just before nightfall, Sorcerer and his assistants performed an act of levitation, hoisting the body high into the trees, into the dark, where it floated under a lovely red moon. John Wade returned home in November of 1969. At the airport in Seattle, he put in a long-distance call to Kathy, but then chuckled and hung up on the second ring. The flight to Minneapolis was lost time. Jet lag, maybe, but something else, too. He felt dangerous. In the gray skies over North Dakota, he went back into the lavatory, where he took off his uniform and put on a sweater and slacks, then carefully appraised himself in the mirror. His eyes looked unsound, a little tired, a little frayed. After a moment, he winked at himself. "Hey, Sorcerer," he murmured. "How's tricks?" In the Twin Cities that evening, he took a bus over to the university. He carried his duffel to the plaza outside Kathy's dorm, found a concrete bench, and sat down to wait. It was shortly after 9 o'clock. Her window was dark, which seemed appropriate, and for a couple of hours he compiled mental lists of the various places she might be, the things she might be doing. Nothing wholesome came to mind. His thoughts then gathered around the topics he would address once the occasion was right. Loyalty, for example, steadfastness and fidelity and trust, and all the related issues of sticking power. It was late, almost midnight, when Kathy turned up the sidewalk to her dorm. She carried a canvas tote bag over her shoulder, a stack of books in her right arm. She'd lost some weight, mostly at the hips, and in the dark she seemed to move with a quicker, nimbler, more impulsive stride. It made him uneasy. After she'd gone inside, John sat very still for a time. Not quite there, not quite anywhere. Then he picked up his duffel and walked the 7 blocks to a hotel. He was still gliding. That dizzy, disconnected sensation stayed with him all night. Exotic fevers swept through his blood. He couldn't get traction on his own dreams. Twice he woke up and stood under the shower, letting the water beat against his shoulders. But even then, the dream reels kept unwinding. Crazy stuff. Kathy shoveling rain off a sidewalk. Kathy waving at him from the wing of an airplane. At one point near dawn, he found himself curled up on the floor, wide awake, conversing with the dark. He was asking his father to please stop dying. Over and over, he kept saying, "Please." But his father wouldn't listen and wouldn't stop. He just kept dying. "God, I love you," John said. And then he curled up tighter and stared into the dark and found himself at his father's funeral, 14 years old, a new black necktie pinching tight. Except the funeral was being conducted in bright sunlight along an irrigation ditch at Tuan Yen. Mourners squatting on their heels and wailing and clawing at their eyes. John's mother and many other mothers. A minister crying, "Sin!" An organist playing organ music. And John wanted to kill everybody who was weeping, and everybody who wasn't. Everybody. the minister and the mourners, and the skinny old lady at the organ. He wanted to grab a hammer and scramble down into the ditch and kill his father for dying. "Hey, I love you," he yelled. "I do!" When dawn came, he hiked over to Kathy's dorm and waited outside on the concrete bench. He wasn't sure what he wanted. In mid-morning, Kathy came out and headed down toward the classroom buildings. The routine hadn't changed. He followed her to the biology lab, then to the student union, then to the post office and bank and gymnasium. From his old spot under the bleachers, he watched as she practiced her dribbling and free throws, which were much improved. And after lunch, he spent a monotonous 3 hours in the library as she leaned over a fat gray psychology textbook. There was nothing out of the ordinary. Several times, in fact, he came close to ending his vigil, just grabbing her, holding tight, and never letting go. But near dark, when she closed her book, he couldn't resist tailing her across campus to a busy kiosk where she bought a magazine, then over to a pizza joint on University Avenue where she ordered a tab and a small pepperoni. He stationed himself at a bus stop outside. His eyes ached. His heart, too. Everything. And there was also the squeeze of indecision. At times he was struck by a fierce desire to believe that the suspicion was nothing but a demon in his head. Other times he wanted to believe the worst. He didn't know why. It was as though something inside him, his genes or his bone marrow, required the certainty of a confirmed betrayal, a witnessed kiss, a witnessed embrace. The facts would be absolute. In a dim way, only half admitted, John understood that the alternative was simply to love her and to go on loving her. Yet somehow the ambiguity seemed intolerable. Nothing could ever be sure, not if he spied forever, because there was always the threat of tomorrow's treachery, or next year's treachery, or the treachery implicit in all the tomorrows beyond that. Besides, he liked spying. He was sorcerer. He had the gift, the knack. It was full dark when Kathy stepped outside. She passed directly behind him, so close he could smell the perfumed soap on her skin. He felt a curious jolt of guilt, almost shame. But for another 10 minutes he tracked her back toward campus, watching as she paused to inspect the shop windows and Thanksgiving displays. At the corner of University and Oak, she used a public telephone, mostly listening, laughing once. Then she continued up toward the school. The evening had a crisp, leafy smell. Football weather, a cool mid-autumn Friday, and the streets were crowded with students and flower kids and lovers going arm in arm. Nobody knew. Their world was safe. All promises were infinite. All things endured. Doubt was on some other planet. Neptune, he thought, which gave him pause. When he looked up, Kathy was gone. For a few moments he had a hard time finding focus. He scanned the sidewalks, shut his eyes briefly, then turned and made his way back to her dorm. He waited all night. He waited through dawn and into early morning. By then, he knew. The knowledge was absolute. It was bone deep and forever, pure knowing. But even then, he waited. He was still there when she came up the sidewalk around noon. Arms folded, powerful, he stood on the steps and watched her move toward him. "I was out," Kathy said. Sorcerer smiled a small, covert smile. "Right," he said. "You were out." They married anyway. It was an outdoor ceremony in the discreetly landscaped yard of her family's house in a suburb west of the Twin Cities. Balloons had been tied to the trees and shrubs. The patio was decorated with Japanese lanterns and red carnations and crepe paper. Altogether, things went nicely. The minister talked about the shield of God's love, which warded off strife, and then recited, too theatrically, John thought, a short passage from 1 Corinthians. Oddly, though, it was not the solemn moment he had once imagined. At one point he glanced over at Kathy and grinned. "And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge..." Her eyes were green and bright. She wrinkled her nose. She grinned back at him. "And though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains..." A lawnmower droned a few houses down. A soft breeze rippled across the yard, and spikes of dusty sunshine made the trees glow, and pink and white balloons danced on their little strings. "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known." Then the minister prayed. They promised to be true to each other. They promised other things, too, and exchanged rings, and afterward Kathy's sister opened the bar. Her mother gave them bed sheets. Her father presented them with the keys to an apartment in Minneapolis. "It's scary," Kathy whispered, "how much I love you." They drove away in a borrowed Chevy to the St. Paul Ramada, where they honeymooned for several days on a package deal. The secrets were his. He would never tell. On the second morning, Kathy asked if he had any misgivings, any second thoughts, and John shook his head and said no. He was sorcerer, after all, and what was love without a little mystery? They moved into the apartment just after Easter. "We'll be happy," Kathy said. "I know it." Sorcerer laughed and carried her inside. The trick, then, was to be vigilant. He would guard his advantage. The secrets would remain secret. The things he'd seen, the things he'd done. He would repair what he could. He would endure. He would go from year to year without letting on that there were tricks. Chapter 8. How the Night Passed. Twice during the night, John Wade woke up sweating. The first time, near midnight, he turned and coiled up against Kathy, brain sick, a little feverish, his thoughts wired to the nighttime hum of lake and woods. A while later, he kicked back the sheets and said, "Kill Jesus." It was a challenge, a dare. He closed his eyes and waited for something terrible to happen, almost hoping, and when nothing happened, he said it again, with authority, then listened for an answer. There was nothing. Quietly, then, John Wade swung out of bed. He moved down the hallway to the kitchen, ran water into an old iron tea kettle, put it on the stove to boil. He was naked. His shoulders were sunburnt, his face waxy with sweat. For a few moments he stood very still, imagining himself kicking and gouging. He'd go for the eyes, yes, he would. Tear out the eyeballs. Fists and fingernails. Just punch and claw and hammer and bite. God, too. He hoped there was a God so he could kill him. The thought was inspiring. He looked at the kitchen ceiling and confided in the void, offering up his humiliation and sorrow. The tea kettle made a light clicking noise. "You too," he said. He shrugged and got out the tea bags and lay down on the kitchen floor to wait. He was not thinking now, just watching the numbers come in. He could see it happening exactly as it happened. Minneapolis was lost. The suburbs, the Iron Range, and the farm towns to the southwest, Pipestone, Marshall, Windham, Jackson, Luverne. A clean, tidy sweep. St. Paul had been lost early. Duluth was lost 4-1. The Unions were lost, and the German Catholics, and the rank-and-file nobodies. The numbers were implacable. There was no pity in the world. It was all arithmetic. A winner, obviously, until he became a loser. Which was how it happened. That quick. One minute you're presidential timber, and then they come at you with chainsaws. It was textbook slippage. It was dishonor and disgrace. Certain secrets had been betrayed. Ambush politics, Tony Carbo said. And so the polls went sour, and in the press there was snide chatter about issues of character and integrity. Front page photographs. Dead human beings in awkward poses. By late August, the whole enterprise had come unraveled. Empty wallets and hedged bets and thinning crowds, old friends with slippery new excuses. And on the first Tuesday after the second Monday in September, he was defeated by a margin of something more than 105,000 votes. John Wade saw it for what it was. Nothing more to hope for. Too ambitious, maybe. Climbing too high or too fast. But it was something he'd worked for. He'd been